All right. We have one with 7 votes. You said, quote, "Thy will be done" is essentially what all prayer is. So does prayer change God's course of action, or does it tend to align us with God's will?
Well, certainly the latter. I mean, we do have God condescending to us in the Bible, which I think is what he does. But he's all-knowing, so there's a sense in which he's already come through that process. He's outside time. He's not controlled by time, so all time is time present to him. But without any question, the primary function of prayer is for us to get to know God. And Jesus does say, when you pray, say the Lord's Prayer. I think he means it. Every time you pray, start with it. Here's an experiment you can do that I learned from Simone Weil, and I do it. Say the Lord's Prayer twice every morning when you open your eyes, before you move. Say it once by rote. And then the second time, ask the Lord to stop you somewhere in the prayer. And use that point as the jumping off point during the day when you have those moments when you go off into fantasy or wasting time on silly games or, you know, Facebook or whatever. Instead, you go to that word. Now, if we wrote the Lord's Prayer, what would the first word be? It wouldn't be our, would it? It'd be my. You can think about the fact that Jesus said, no, start with our, don't start with my. And you can think about that for the rest of your life, because you'll constantly default to my even when you're saying our. That's our problem. We are navel-gazing narcissists, basically, and he's trying to cure us of that. So you say the Lord's Prayer twice every morning, you won't give up. The next thing you can do, and again, I wish I was been taught this earlier. Most of you will go through periods of your life when your world is not working well. You're not enjoying the scriptures. You're probably not reading them. You're not praying. All those things happen. Most people have periods like that. Not all. If I meet those that don't have it, I ask them to pray for me. And they do. It's amazing. I remember years ago seeing 3 young women sitting in the front row, doing a medical student conference with some students about your age. And when I said most of you are going to go through probably quite lengthy periods when you don't pray and you don't read the Bible, you don't have any subjective sense of faith. And the look of pure horror on her face, she said, I can't imagine a day without Jesus. She's a missionary kid. She'd grown up in India. She said, I talk to Jesus every day. And clearly, she knew him in a way that I didn't. I said, well, please pray for me. I met her 20 years later. She was at a conference. I walked in, I recognized her, and she recognized me. We both took a moment, and she said, I said, I remember you. And she said, I remember you too, and I have prayed for you every day since. That is amazing. And I have that sense quite often. You can. Sometimes I get myself in too deep, and I, you know, if you're coming up for the 6th talk in a single day, you're a bit tired at the end of the day. It's often the best talk of the day. And on one occasion, a woman came up afterwards, and she said, she's very strange, I've never said this to anyone in the world before, but I had the distinct impression somebody was standing next to you. I think she was right. We live at a very low level of what God intends us to have. And prayer is the way to realize how much further it can go. My favorite books are not written by evangelicals on this. There's a little book written by a Greek Orthodox called School for Prayer. His name is Alan Bloom. He's obviously not Russian in origin. But what he has to say about prayer, I found very, very, very helpful. Particularly the role of repetitive prayer. Not meditatively, it has a role, and you'll find it. The other thing that I wish I'd been taught earlier on is that when you hit the bottom, the place to go is the Psalms, but you can only go there if you know them. So in your early Christian life, you need to inhabit the Psalms in a deep way. If you read a Psalm every day, you'll go through the Psalms twice a year. In a few years, you'll know them well. If you do two a day, which is perfectly doable, you'll get there even quicker. So you know where to go on a very bad day. There are about six psalms that begin in misery and end in misery. So at least you know that somebody who ultimately wrote psalms has been in the same place that you're currently in, and you stop being quite so sorry for yourself. You're not the first to go through these things. It's part of the training program. There's even a verse for residency. Yeah, you probably didn't know that, but there is. Psalm 119, it's somewhere in the 80s, but it goes like this. It says, I have become like a dried up old wineskin in the smoke. That's a pretty good description of what a Christian resident feels like. It said, when will you punish those attendings who are punishing me? I've only added one word, but I've done nothing to the context, really. And of course, in the end, it does change. You need to know where to go on a bad day. That's why you need to inhabit the Psalms first, so that you don't get lost. And of course, some of them come alive to you in particular ways, because there will be a moment when something important happened because of them. And they become richer as time goes on. That's the point about the Scriptures. There's no other book in the world that you can read for 20 years and then suddenly a verse pops up and you say, how did I miss that? I mean, like the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount and the beginning of John 13. You've read that many, many times, but I know most of you have not noticed it. We take forever to notice these things. It amazes me. How can I read so badly? And I did. I'm going to stop. That will do for now. If you've got more questions, but praying the Psalms, you see, is something you can do. Putting yourself into the shoes of the person who's written the Psalms. For your age group, for instance, do you know Psalm 73? Obviously not. Learn it. I call it the university student psalm. It's perfect for people going away from home for the first time. It's written, I'm sure, by an old man, but he's looking back on life. And he begins by saying, as for me, my foot had well nigh slipped. He was in trouble of losing it all. He said, I was envious of the rich. And he lays out this temptation. Now, he's turned around. There are two turning points in the psalm, in my view. The first one is very interesting. It's just good manners, the sort of thing that my wife would teach and a Mennonite church would teach. He says, if I say what I think, I will break the hearts of those I love. So he couldn't do it. He doesn't come to the solution till a little later. He says, it wasn't until I went into the house of the Lord and I saw that the wicked have their feet in slippery places. What a fool I was. All I need is found in you, O Lord. And it's one of the first psalms that has a real sense of future, that we will be with him in eternity. So just one psalm. I heard Lloyd-Jones preach on it for several Sundays. And when he wrote the book about it, he said one man came in, he'd come all the way from South Africa to London, everything was in a mess, and he was wandering through Westminster, and he just happened to go into Westminster Chapel that night. And Lloyd-Jones' text that night was simply the word nevertheless. And he put everything on one side of the scale, nevertheless Christ, in an incredible way. And the guy was converted. And he learned about that later. It's called from, what's it called? I can't remember the title of the book, but a whole book on Psalm 73. So that kind of thing can happen. You go deeper and it gets richer and richer.
Thank you. Could you speak to vaccinations for children? What are the pros and cons, and are they ethical?
Can you repeat that, because I didn't quite get it?
Could you speak to vaccinations?
Oh.
Vaccines for children. What are the pros and cons, and are they ethical?
Yeah.
And I it's not part of this question, but I think part of this is the ethics of their derived cell lines.
Yes, so I know it is.
Okay.
Yeah. Not an easy, it's a good question, and it's not an easy one to answer with total satisfaction. Knowing the history of vaccination, it is vaccination for a good reason. I mean, vacca is the, or wacca, depending on where you learnt your Latin, is the Latin word for cow. And the reason for that is very simple, that the first effective vaccine was in the 18th century, and it was Jenner, who was a country doctor, but an observant one, and there was a smallpox outbreak. And he noticed that milkmaids didn't get smallpox. And so he talked to them all. He said, none of the milkmaids have got smallpox. Do you have any idea why? And one of them said, well, we do get things that look like smallpox on our fingers. We now know it was cowpox. So he took some of that pus from a cowpox blister, and he did an unethical experiment because he used the village idiots. And he vaccinated him with that stuff and got the red reaction that you get. It can be quite painful. And then he exposed him to smallpox and he didn't get it. That the hide of the cow that the smallpox had come from was hanging in the library of St. George's Hospital Medical School, where I trained. That was the first effective immunization process. Before that, people had noticed that these things die out, and at the end of the epidemic, you can expose your children to it, and it's not so virulent, but still dangerous. But cowpox took that out completely. So it's a long story. If you know the Lord's Prayer well, you know which bit you should be thinking of now. What is it? Well, it's, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. I mean, what we do as doctors and what you do as parents is try and reverse the effects of the fall as far as you are able. Muslims who are committed to everything being Allah's will are deeply conflicted as doctors. What are they doing interfering with Allah's will? We're not interfering with God's will when we help the sick. He told us to do that. We are showing the beginnings of the new life. The world changed when Jesus came. It was never the same after that. So vaccination and immunization has been one of the most powerful tools for improving health. I mean, even in America, before, there wasn't an effective treatment apart from vaccination against smallpox until 1865 or thereabouts. From Hippocrates to 1865, those who went to the doctor were more likely to die than those who didn't. The wealthy were more likely to die than the poor. That's how bad medicine was. I mean, people went because it gave them reassurance that somebody knew what was happening to them. And that's still therapeutic, but it didn't cure disease. And it wasn't until Lister basically poured carbolic acid into the wound from a compound fracture before he put the fracture together again and cleaned up the dead tissue and sewed the boy up. No one had survived a compound fracture before that. Everybody had died because there was always dirt involved, and he died of septicemia. That boy survived the first time, the beginning of a new age, cleanliness in that case. But vaccination was part of it. And some vaccines are so good, it's unbelievable. I mean, First World War, lots of soldiers died of tetanus. And they were prepared for the same thing in the Second World War, but we had a new vaccine. Only one person died of tetanus in the Second World War, an American sergeant who admitted before he died that he'd bribed the guy who was doing the injections not to give him the shot. So he hadn't been vaccinated. He hadn't had the tetanus shock. The tetanus vaccine is superb. I mean, there's no problems attached to it of any sort. So what we're coming to now is, how much do you need to know about how we learn things? Well, nasty people have taught us things at various times along the way. You can't unlearn things you know. That's not a human ability. It may be, nobody can be absolutely certain of how cell lines come along in the long run. I mean, working with cell cultures is not a science in many respects. We think we know where we got the first cells from. We cannot be absolutely certain. Certainly, aborted fetuses have been used for cell cultures, but that doesn't mean aborted necessarily by man. The greatest abortionist is God. Three out of four pregnancies at least end in spontaneous abortion that you usually don't even know about, but the doctor can still find the cells in the tissue. I don't know the details. What I do know is if you don't vaccinate your children against measles, for instance, you are climbing on the backs of those who do vaccinate. And the level of immunization is dropping. Before we had that vaccine, there were measles years and non-measles years. Every 4 years, there would be a spike. The pediatric ward that I worked in would have been full of measles cases. And a good number of those children would die. Others would end up blind, deaf. It is a very serious disease of children. And you are going to feel absolutely awful if your child is so seriously damaged by measles vaccination, by measles, because you didn't vaccinate them. I certainly would go ahead and use them. Redeeming what you can of what was evil is not a bad thing to do. Choosing the lesser of two evils is part of theology. It has to be. We're frequently required to choose the lesser of two evils. I imagine you can put your last election in that category. You had to choose the lesser of two evils, and I think you've made the right choice personally, but a lot of people would disagree. We do it all the while. We have to. That's the human condition. I love what Lewis puts into the mouth of Screwtape in the Screwtape Letters, where Screwtape, writing to Wormwood, says, "And he forgives them on the monstrous grounds that they intended to do well." Christ doesn't look at your actions, he looks at your intent. And I think he made mothers mothers. They don't need to crucify themselves when their motherly concern should surely be primarily for the good of the child. This is a very difficult question. I may have given the wrong answer, but I'm sure that he will forgive us on the monstrous grounds that we intend to do well. It has changed the world for better. Cooperate. Now, the problems are much greater when you come to things like human papillomavirus and girls who are not going to have illicit sex. Are you going to vaccinate your children or not? It's a very difficult one. The answer, of course, is that in the modern world, nasty things happen. And human papillomavirus is the cause of, 95% of cancer of the cervix in women. And it doesn't need to happen. So for that reason alone, you could go ahead and do it. But it's a difficult one. It's problematic. Do you do good? Regardless of whether other things that are involved, the whole question of are we encouraging loose living when we say we can protect you against a disease? I don't think it's a good argument. I don't think Jesus would put it that way. He would want to make the positive statement. That's the reality out there. The world is a difficult place. But if you live according to my laws, you will be much better off. He promises that. If you will keep this law, it will go well with you and your children. And one sees that time and time again. Not a satisfactory answer in all respects, but I think the plea to be vaccinated is based on the reality of seeing the horror that happens that's totally preventable.
Thank you. I've had a very hard time being dogmatic about an answer on that one, too.
Yeah,
I mean, personal opinions, and I tend to keep them kind of quiet.
Well, pray about it a lot, and the Lord will push you in the right direction.
Next question. If you failed your children teaching until they are 7 years old, what can you do to gain back that ground?
You can't, unfortunately, but he does give you a second chance, and your grandchildren. So second time round, you can do better. But I mean, it's gone. The world is morally consequential, and you have done things that will have consequences. I mean, the current state of America, the primary problem for America, in my view, is absentee fathers. That is absolutely huge. And I don't understand what happened, because you may or may not know this, but at the beginning of the last century, the illegitimacy rate in black families and white families was the same, and it was very low, in single digits. That was at the 1900s, and during the Industrial Revolution, the books by Gertrude Himmelfarb from Harvard, who was a professor of English and was very interested in Victorian literature, and doing the background, she was amazed to find these incredibly low illegitimacy rates in both Britain and America. Now, the black community fell off the wagon, so to speak, in the 1930s, and I don't know why. And I have yet to find a black scholar who can tell me what it was that pushed it at that point. We lost our way following the Second World War, and there were two reasons for that, of course. One was men coming back from war, where they had seen and done terrible things. It's hard for them to reintegrate, and in many cases, they'd had illicit sex during the war, too. The other thing was the contraceptive pill. And the two curves are parallel with a 20-year gap, or a bit more than 25-year gap. So if you want to know what white society is going to look like with respect to fathering and divorce, but particularly fathering, it's what the black community is like now. Will be our state in 25 years, would be the direct extrapolation. It's not a small thing, it's huge. Over 75% of black young men in America don't know for certain who their father is. And that's probably true of the upper classes amongst us too. They've always been promiscuous. So that's a huge problem at that level. Now, I've forgotten where I started on this. You have to help me for a moment.
How to regain ground if we lost the teaching.
So regaining of ground is not available to you directly, but you can help others. I mean, when we had this thing, the March for Men, being reconciled with their children, nobody taught them Deuteronomy 6. That's the key. Teach it to your children, the stories of the Bible before the age of 7. And do it to your grandchildren. Children will turn the television off, they'll turn everything off for parents or grandparents to read to them. When my wife came back from the refugee camps, basically with post-traumatic burnout, thank God we had lots of grandchildren, because she was granny, and her therapy, she would read to those children for hours. And they would curl up with a book and listen to her for hours. That was the best therapy she could have. And we miss out when we don't read with our children. Everybody should read the Narnia stories to their children, you know. There are good books out there. There's some new ones as well as old ones. And we need to work very hard on this, and you do get literate children out of it. So when we never had a television like most of you, because when we arrived in North America, I said to the children, look, there are so many channels, and none of them, in my view, are really worth watching. But what do you want to do? We'd been in Britain for a year from between Jamaica and here, where at least you could have television without advertising. But bless them, they said, it was better in Jamaica, where we didn't have a television. We played more games, we talked more, we won't have a television. So we never had a television till the youngest was 15, when our neighbor was leaving and nobody had taken their functional television out, and they said, oh, we don't want to put it in the garbage, will you take it? And it was hardly used, because we were post-television. It was used for the news occasionally, that's all. But the children, it was amazing. My oldest is a very sociable sort of person, but she discovered very quickly that television is so bad, she could go to school and she knew what the soap operas did yesterday, because it was so predictable. I mean, the whole point about soap operas, you know exactly what's going to happen. It's just a question of who's getting into bed with whom, and the odd throwaway line, and you can join in the conversation without any trouble, never having seen any of it. And of course, when they got to university, they were light years ahead, because they'd read, on average, 10 times as many books as their peer group. Our church, the church we joined when we got to Ottawa, was aware that these problems were happening, and they had a reading competition every year. They stopped it the year after our family arrived, because it was embarrassing. They were counting little books like this, and my 8-year-old counted the whole of the Lord of the Rings as one book and still one, you know. He would respond only to the name Aragorn for about 2 years of his life, you know. I didn't mind if he turns out like him. I thought that won't be a bad deal. But children need these stories in their lives. Reading to children is a very important function. Don't underestimate what you're doing when you're reading to your children and your grandchildren, especially if you guide them into better reading. One of the best things we did, teenagers don't tell you what they're reading, and I wanted to know what my teenagers' grandchildren were doing. So I talked to Sally about it, and we decided we would give a Kindle to our children, our grandchildren, as soon as they start asking interesting questions. And tell them, we'll buy your books. That meant I would be able to see what they're reading. What I hadn't appreciated was that I was giving them access to my account. So they were reading my books too. So I had a 17-year-old who's read everything Lewis has written. And he knows where it's found. He was in Africa. That's pretty amazing. But when you're young, if you haven't been contaminated by television, you can read all day. Modern children can't. Their concentration span is very short compared to what it used to be. And when marijuana, which we've now legalized in Canada, works its way through, it'll be even shorter. The worst effect of marijuana is that, without any question, shortens your concentration span permanently. That's not a small thing. So the way in which we live matters. Okay, you missed out first time. You can be a crusader to help other people. Find the books. Give books away. I mean, when you go into a second-hand bookshop, pick up every Lewis you see, every decent book you see, and give them away. Cast your bread upon the waters. It's hard if you're a book lover, but they do come back. I once had a doctor come into my office in Ottawa. He'd been sent by another doctor because he was going to Zaire to work in the refugee camps there with Medicine Sans Frontières, and he came to see me, and he said, I've come because they tell me you've been in that area many times. Yes, I said, I know it well. And we talked for a while, and Medicine Sans Frontières is an immoral organization. But as he was leaving, I gave him two books, which are on my shelf, Mere Christianity and Peter Kreif's book on suffering. I said, you might find these useful when it gets really bad. About 2 years later, I went into the office and there was a parcel in my pigeonhole. When I opened it, there were four books, the two I'd lent plus two copies so that I can give more away next time. He said these were the only two books that I could read for quite a long while. Thank you. Cast your bread upon the waters, but you must have read it yourself first. I'm tempted, should I give in to temptation, that suggesting a book that you might be surprised by. Well, I will. I have a friend called Michael O'Brien. Anybody know him as an author? Not the one who writes the sea stories. You know the other ones, do you? What? No, this is Michael O'Brien, and he publishes with Ignatius. Island of the World, yeah. The greatest novel I've ever read. Well done. So somebody here reads already. You haven't managed to persuade someone else to read it yet. You should. That's your job. Oh, some more. Good. Michael's an amazing man. He's a friend. He has no university education. He has 10 children, I think. He made his living painting icons, and then God gave him a story. The first one, Father Elijah, he told me he wrote between 1 and 3 in the morning because that was the only time when the house was quiet, and every sentence was prayed over. And it reads that way. But Island of the World is the most stunning book I've ever read. It reduced you to tears and prayers several times, right? Of course. Everybody that I've talked to and has read it usually emails me afterwards. My favorite one of late was a lovely lady from Jamaica, a pediatrician who was would have been a Mennonite lady, but it was the Brethren. And I caught her one day reading trashy romantic Christian novels. And I said, Kay, you can do better than that. And she said, like what? And so I gave her Island of the World to read. About a month later, I got an email. It said, I'm reading slower and slower because I can't imagine what I'm going to do when I get to the end of this book. But I promise you, I will never read another double-spaced Christian romantic novel in my life. And she has changed the reading habits of her church and the students in the university to a considerable degree since. It's an amazing story. I won't tell you any more than that, but you follow the life of one man from a little boy with an absolutely horrendous start to an amazing end, which is still sad, but not for Christians. And he's written about 10 novels. All over the world, there are people who know him now as an author. When I first talked about him to evangelical audiences, I thought that I would not be invited to do so again, but just the opposite. I meet so many members of CMDA, the Evangelical Doctors Organization, who thank me for introducing them to Michael O'Brien. They've read them all. I haven't had time to read them all. There's still two or three I need to get through, but they're stunning books. And what we read that grows our soul is important. And then you share it with other people. There is a book list on my website, and it says at the top, these are books I have actually enjoyed, as opposed to books as a Christian I'm supposed to enjoy. So it includes the enemy. You've got to know your enemy. You've got to read both. Any other questions?
Yes, maybe one more.
I wanted to say one other thing as well, so we'll do the question first. Not about that, about
okay. Let's do one more. This may be jumping into your next talk here, but I don't think we'll have time for questions. What would you say to someone that says it is better to have an abortion than to have another unwanted child put in an orphanage or in the foster care system?
Okay, I will leave that for the next talk. I hope the person who asked it will be there, but it will be recorded anyway, because there isn't a short answer to that.
Let's jump to one more. Can we jump to one more now?
I want to do one thing that's important. I want you to read better, and I know how to make you do it. Years ago, I stopped teaching in the conventional way for ethical reasons. I was invigilating a Christmas exam with, 1,000 students in the gym. And 10 minutes after the start, I was given a note saying there'd been a bomb scare just received by the university. There was a bomb in the gym, they said. I thought the timing was very, very suspicious, but you have to take them seriously. So I said, there's been what I'm sure is a hoax, but we're told there's a bomb somewhere in this building. Pick up your bag, leave your question paper on the desk, pick up your coat, go for a 20-minute walk. It'll take that long. I put my coat on as well. I got to the far end of the parking lot, and there were a group of students gathered around the back of an open truck, and they said, "Ah, you idiots, you were supposed to memorize the third question." It was obvious that they were involved in the bomb scare. And then I realized they all went out in a very orderly fashion. Maybe they all knew about it, including my students. Well, I knew cheating was getting more and more sophisticated, and it was bothering me, and I wanted to find a way to make cheating of no value. That was the only thing I could do. And then I realized students don't know how to read. So I turned my biochemistry course into a course reading the biochemical literature at the first level and showing them how to read, because they didn't know. And the way you do that is by learning the art of precy. In the Middle Ages, the way that they found out whether you could think, when you're in your 20s, you don't have anything to say that anybody needs to listen to. You know, that's later. So you give them a book that everybody knows is very important and very difficult to read. And what they have to do is write an account of that book, which doesn't show anything of themselves, simply what the author has actually said. And if they capture it, they get their masters. They don't, they don't. And that is the way to learn to write a text, write a précis. It's the French word for precise without the terminal E. And Ephesians was mentioned today, and I often use that as an example. No, it wasn't mentioned. I read a magazine this morning in which it was mentioned. a Mennonite magazine, and they miss the point. But that's beside the point too. But you've read Ephesians 1 and 2 many times, right? Could any of you stand up and tell me the argument? I know the answer is no, certainly for the vast majority of you. If you write a praise, you will never forget the argument again. And what you do is you make every complex sentence simple, and Ephesians 1, verses 2 to 12 are one sentence in Greek. You want to break it down into simple Anglo-Saxon sentences. No participles, no metaphors or similes, remove all the rhetoric, all the trimmings, which Paul likes, isn't it? They make beautiful reading. You want to get down to the basic argument, and you'll end up with a very clear structure that he clearly had in his mind, but he was on a high. He was just going at 100 knots, and I feel very sorry for the guy who had to copy it down and write it down as he was dictating. It must have been horrendous to take down Paul's dictation. But you can take two chapters and reduce them to 20 lines. Do it by hand, because something happens when you write cursively that you don't get when you do letters that you do on your phone. It's a different process, different pathway. And you will know the argument at the end of it. If you put praise into Google, you'll find some examples to teach you how to do it. But it's the best thing you can teach your child to do. Anybody doing a PhD, for instance, who learns to write a good praise, takes a year off their PhD. They think they've got their PhD when they've got the data. You're only halfway there at the time. I had a flying over the Atlantic a few years ago, and halfway across the Atlantic, a young woman walked down the aisle. And as she got to my seat, I was sitting there, she stopped and looked, and then she went on. But when she came back, she stopped. And she said, "You're Professor Patrick, aren't you?" I said, "Yes." She said, "Do you remember me?" And I said, "I'm sorry, no." And she laughed. She said it was 20 years ago. "I'm a professor myself now, and I use your methods. It's nice to meet you. You took a year off my PhD. Because most scientific PhDs will have about 12 papers at the heart of them. And the candidates will be reading those papers continuously for 3 or 4 years. I tell them, no, sit down. Spend 2 months writing a good praise of each of those papers. Then you will know where the weaknesses are in the argument and the strengths, and you would toss one or two of the papers out knowing that you can trash them. You've written your introduction, and you know where the questions are. You will refine your research much more precisely because you've defined the questions. That's what it does. So I started doing this with students. I gave them a paper, sometimes a good one, sometimes a bad one, sometimes a mediocre one, and I'd go through quickly the biochemistry involved and say, "Now, take that paper, write me a praise." The first time they did it, they were too proud to say they didn't know what a praise was. So these were A students. None of them got a mark over 50% on that exercise. They hadn't seen a mark that low, ever. It was a very uncomfortable moment. I said, "Relax. The only lesson you learn today is one about pride. When you don't know something, don't pretend you do. Say so. Nothing wrong with ignorance. It's what you fail to do with your ignorance that's your problem." And they learned how to do it. And I, in the next couple of years, picked up two students who had an academic career entirely because they took my course, because they couldn't hack, memorize and dump. So they didn't get good marks for the first 3 years in university, which is all memorize and dump in the science faculty, particularly biology. But now I was asking them to read, understand, rewrite, and then I asked them to plan. And what more could you ask of a graduate student? One of them has, I don't know, $250,000 a year coming in grants, and wouldn't have got into graduate school because of the ridiculous way we select students if she hadn't taken my course. So start with the Bible, because every passage you've written a praise about will come alive in a way that it didn't before. Enough for now? Precise, you can spell that word. No E on the end. And an accent grave on the first E. But you don't need that. Google will give it you without the accent.
I think we'll stop with that.
Yep.
And, thank you so much.
My pleasure.